This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Carlos Slocum's great uncle was a barber in a rural town in Alabama. He was black. And one day, a white barber showed up and declared that he was now the town barber and pushed her uncle out. Her great uncle headed west to a historically black town in Oklahoma. Her grandfather followed and later devoted his work to research on historically black communities. Carla has also followed along that path. She's a professor of anthropology and the director of the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And she's co-organizer of a Black Communities Conference happening next week in Durham. And she's on the program now. Carla Slocum, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us more about the lineage and the sort of your ancestors and how they came to be interested in Black communities.
Well, my grandfather really got started with the research because of his brother's connection, his connection to his brother. He knew about the communities because he had learned about his own brother's path from migrating from Alabama to Oklahoma to become a resident of Boley, Oklahoma, which is the largest, one of the largest black towns in Oklahoma. So from there, really, I feel like we've all sort of come full circle in the sense of it was my grandfather who was doing the research in the community. As a result, my mother grew up in the community. I heard her stories about her uncle and other family members that lived in Oklahoma and her own life there in the communities. And it intrigued me. I study small rural communities as an anthropologist. That's always been my focus, and this seemed like a natural fit based on the kind of work I do.
What should we know about those communities? They were mostly intentional communities. I mean, obviously, there are black communities that are there because of segregation. They're not intentional, or at least not the intent of the people who live there. But this is different, these rural communities. So tell us about them and if there's any sort of commonalities among all of those communities.
There are commonalities across them. So what we know in the United States, there were up to 200 historic, what we call black towns, historic black towns. And they mostly were in the South and the West, very few in the Northeast. And what we know about them is that they were, as you mentioned, intentional communities in the sense that black people came together to try to form communities that were kind of a safe haven for them during the Jim Crow era. We're talking about the post-emancipation period where people were searching for places that could fulfill greater, more could do a better job of fulfilling the promise of freedom. And they were actually often following the ideas and inspiration of Booker T. Washington, who was a motivator in the sense that he always advocated for black Americans to form economic activities that would support themselves. So these were meant to be self-sustaining, economically vibrant black communities.
And education was critical to all of these communities, was it not?
Education was absolutely critical. What we have in all the black towns that we know of is that they all had their own schools. Sometimes towns had multiple schools for their populations. And the schools, it was a sense of educating your own and educating them in the ways that they would not be educated in schools outside of those communities.
So tell us about the conference then next week in Durham. What are you looking at?
So the conference, Black Communities, a Conference for Collaboration, is a focus, is an attempt to bring people together from a variety of walks of lives who are interested and invested in black communities. Really, the conference got started with an event at UNC in 2015. It was an event spearheaded by the Center for the Study of the American South, the Southern Historical Collection, and the Kenan Institute of Private Enterprise that came together and invited mayors of six historic black towns in the Southeast to come to UNC to really participate in a symposium that would look at challenges facing the communities and the ways that certain resources, especially research, could be leveraged to work with the communities on things like preservation, healthcare, economic development, developing cultural tourism, these sorts of things. So our conference now, 3 years later, is an attempt to go larger scale than that, not just focusing on the Southeast, not just focusing on historic communities, but focusing on black communities writ large. We don't limit it to place, so we're actually thinking about collectives of black people, social movements, etc. And what we are interested in is collaboration. That's the word that I would highlight from the title of our conference, in the sense that we are looking for faculty, students, community members, representatives of NGOs who work in black communities, activists, artists, to all convene and think about the ways that they can partner, collaborate, in support of Black communities in a whole variety of ways, and also exchange information and ideas.
And in that first meeting of the mayors of various communities, Princeville, North Carolina, represented, right?
Princeville was represented. There were three towns from North Carolina that were represented, but Princeville was certainly one of them.
Well, let's talk about that story. And to do that, I want to talk with Mark Little, who is the director of NC Growth and the executive director at the UNC Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise. Mark Little, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here, Frank.
Let's talk about these communities, and particularly a community like Princeville. How does that fit into the picture and into this conversation that we're having right now?
So it really fits in, I think, in a very central way. As Carla pointed out, it was part of that initial convening. But even in terms of the history of Black communities, the story of it is unique in that it was the first town founded by freed slaves in the United States, but also one that I think speaks to the idea of sort of freedom internationally, which is really this conference that we're hosting now. So Princeville was founded in 1885 during Reconstruction, had a vibrant economic present or time during for about 100 years, and where it is now is quite different. And so the story of that change is really a story of a lot of these Black communities that we're have a focus on in the conference. The other way that it's Princeville is a focus of the conference is we've managed to have a really amazing collaboration between academics, business sector, and Princeville, which will be highlighted at the conference.
Talk about the business sector and how that fits in.
Sure. So with Princeville in particular, we have a very interesting and perhaps unique partnership here. So Skanska, which is a huge builder around the world, has partnered with Princeville because of the unique story of Princeville and sees the value of supporting a community like that. And we actually started that partnership a couple of years ago, right before Hurricane Matthew came, and I'm sure you and listeners know about.
We should talk about that just briefly, if we can step back for a moment, because now Princeville is facing some very serious challenges and even questions about whether to rebuild, given its location in a floodplain.
Well, if you ask many of the folks in Princeville, there's no question about rebuilding. So in the work that I do at the university, I'm basically, you can say, I'm a community organizer and program developer. And so we always start with what the community wants and needs. Folks at Princeville are going to rebuild. And so the way we look at that is how can we support that in culturally representative, responsive ways. And as I mentioned, so Skanska has come to the table to support on sort of technical assistance side. But to your point that you asked earlier about how do you get business more invested, involved in these communities? And so I think it's a fundamental question in Princeville. It's also a fundamental question here in Durham. I mean, I grew up here and I came to Durham every weekend, and where Durham is now is very different than when I was little. Looks very different in lots of ways. The people who are walking around downtown as well as the storefronts look different. And so how you can get investment in Black communities when sort of the financial infrastructure in Black communities. So Black banks, for the most part, don't exist. We do have M&F Bank here in Durham, but many, if not, I think most of all, the rest of them have dissipated. So how do you do that? And so the work that I do when I'm not organizing this conference with Carla really is really trying to.
Well, and let's talk about that, because the disparity there, you can get lots of investment in cities with large Black populations like Durham, but then they tend to displace those populations, or at least the poor population, and to the extent that it correlates, then the Black population. We're talking about gentrification. No problem gentrifying encouraging investment here, but a place like Princeville, where we don't have the investment to begin with, then it's just a harder sell.
It's a harder sell, but it's similar. I mean, Carla's research is around these sort of historic Black communities in rural areas, but there are distinct connections between those and Black communities in a place like Durham. And so I think actually some of the questions are similar. How do you engage these people? So just down the street from Princeville is Rocky Mount. Lots of things happening in Rocky Mount right now, but not really involving Princeville or Black parts of Tarboro, et cetera, et cetera. So, how do you get to that answer? Those are one of the questions we're going to be talking about at the conference. I mean, I think that's going to take up probably two worth of your shows on how to actually do that. But
we'll talk a little bit about Skanska and why a big, multinational, a construction corporation like that. How are they involved, and kind of what's in it for them?
Right. So the how is it's changed. Before the hurricane, it was really about actual physical infrastructure and building. After the hurricane, it came, how can this huge company with all these resources be a technical advisor to a town, a small town? How can they bring, their PR machine and their planners to help Princeville navigate all of the stuff that's going on right now? And they're just about to launch a big PR campaign if you can believe it, the first town founded by freed slaves in the United States is not in the Blackstonian. So for listeners who don't know what the Blackstonian is, the New Smithsonian Museum in D.C., the National Museum for African American Culture and History, it's not in the museum, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to be one of the things. So, but you asked also, what do they get out of it? What does a company like Skanska get out of it? I think being in North Carolina, being in the United States, we sort of don't really understand the hugeness of what this means. To me, it's the same hugeness that a place like Haiti has. Haiti is the only country on this planet that was founded by freed slaves. Princeville is the first town formed by freed slaves in the United States. That's an international human history story. A company like Skanska that's based outside of the United States sees that, and they see the value to them. It's like, oh, we're going to support this unique, amazing community that's not unlike all these other historic black communities. So they're very excited about it. I mean, I've gone in rooms of middle managers from across the world at Skanska who are excited about the town of Princeville, and there's people 10 minutes from Princeville that I talk to also work with who are like, why are you working in Princeville? Mm-hmm. There's nothing happening there. Right.
So that speaks volumes about the need for this kind of conference, and again, to bring people together into the room and talk about the sort of developments and some of the challenges that you face. And of course, investment in infrastructure is key among them. But there are other problems as well that can be addressed when we're talking about black communities. One of the threats to black communities, of course, mass incarceration, families torn apart by a parent being arrested, and when they return from prison, often can't find work, have a difficult time reconnecting with family and community. Our next guest is doing research on the impact of mass incarceration on black families. Patrice Collins is a fellow of the Urban Ethnography Project and the Comer School Development Program at Yale University. Also a panel guest for the upcoming Black Communities Conference, and she joins us now. Patrice, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. So wonderful to be here with you all.
Well, it's good to have you with us. So talk about this piece of it, this business of mass incarceration and where it fits in the conversation about black communities.
Great. Yeah. So our talk this weekend on the panel will be focusing on the prevalence of criminal justice and how that impacts black communities, specifically looking at the continuum when we think about the end of that continuum, children and families. So my particular focus will look at how children and families are impacted by this prevalence culture of hypercriminalization within black communities. And that is something that there is possibility and a lot of potential for positive outcomes of mass incarceration when we think about support and resiliency, protective factors that can be in place. And we're looking forward to discussing some of those resources and possibilities for families that are experiencing negative outcomes of having a parent or a family member in and out of prison or jail.
Well, talk about some of those now. What is the impact on children, for instance?
So some of the things that we see is that children that are growing up in families and communities where there's a high prevalence of intergenerational cycles of incarceration are oftentimes making statements such as, when I grow up, I want to go to jail, like my dad or my mom. And these are young children that are saying these things, children under 5 years old. And because of that statement, what we can obviously see from that is this culture of prison and jail being so normal in this child's life. And also, it speaks to the sense of loss that this child may be experiencing by missing their parent. They might not necessarily associate jail as a negative place or prison as a negative place because that's where their parent is or that's where their close family member is. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed, and also addressed in a very sensitive way when we think about how we communicate with educators, the implications of that, and the implications of stakeholders that are invested in black communities and thinking about the future of black families.
And of course, then there are all the complications and difficulties associated with reentry for that individual coming back. Maybe it's been years, dozens of years since they've lived in that community. Things have changed. And of course, finding a job, et cetera, very difficult. Talk about the impact there and some of the solutions, some of the ideas that you're talking about.
Right. So that is a huge impact. Housing, employment, some of the necessary survival things that are needed to support your family, to support your identity as a primary caregiver to your child after you're returning from being away from your child's life for a period of time due to incarceration, there are support services available, and we'll be highlighting that on our panel. For example, the National Resource Center for Children and Families of the Incarcerated has a directory of programs that highlight reentry services that can help families that are dealing with the inability to obtain a job after their incarceration or to have the economic stability to provide for their family and to make significant significant moments of interactions with their child. For example, if a parent is removed due to incarceration, but they were living with that child prior to incarceration, coming back into the family system may not be just, I'm going to come back. Most people that have experienced long periods of time in the prison or jail systems have to live in halfway houses. And that can be very complicated when you think about children's access to their parent and even thinking about children that may not possibly have known their parent prior to incarceration. So that's another variation that we see. So the complexities around family reunification are very, very large, and we need to think about how we can address unique family systems that may be dealing with different complications due to their experience prior to their incarceration.
I know you.
And I think,
Go ahead.
Please, I was just going to say sometimes thinking about the family context prior to the incarceration is left out of the discussion when we think about family reunification. And it's a long process that needs to be thought in regards to all the individuals involved, the primary caregiver during the incarceration and the primary caregiver after the incarceration, but most importantly, the children and where are they in the discussion of family reunification.
I know you've done research on men returning from prison. What's the difference between those who successfully reconnect and those who don't?
I think some of the things that I've seen and I've heard from different fathers that were dealing with being in incarceration and being away from their children, some of the things that have attributed to their successes was their relationship with the primary caregiver of their children prior to the incarceration. One of those things may be the positive relationship they have with the child's mother or the positive relationship they have with their child's grandmother who may be taking care of the children. Also, that identity of being able to come back into their children's lives has increased their successes, their identity as a father, being able to be seen as not guilty or always innocent in front of their child. So no matter what their past was, they're always seen as a hero to their child and how meaningful that is in their ability to see themselves be doing well for themselves and for their families compared to other fathers that may not have that same experience coming out and not having a place to identify with their children, or they might have not have a positive relationship with the child's grandmother or the child's mother, and that can often deter a positive relationship that father is able to maintain and sustain with the children, and then you don't necessarily see the same success outcomes.
Carla Slocum, given the scope and the complexity of these issues that we're talking about, what's your hope that for the outcome of this conference?
My hope is really that there will be a lot of collaboration and the kinds of exchange of discussion that we're actually having here, where people can learn from one another about their respective knowledge, whether it's your lived experience, knowledge from your lived experience, or knowledge from your research, or knowledge from your activism, and that kind of exchange and networking to develop some possible projects. We have dedicated a lot of space through the conference for the purpose exclusively of networking, and we're hoping that people will take advantage of that and really connect with one another.
Great stuff. Thank you all for being on the program. Carla Slocum is an anthropology professor and the director of the Institute of African American Research at UNC Chapel Hill and the co-organizer of the Black Communities Conference. Mark Little is the director of NC Growth and the executive director at UNC Kenan Institute of Private Enterprise. And Patrice Collins is a fellow for Urban Ethnography Project at the Comer School Development Program at Yale University. She will be a speaker at the upcoming Black Communities Conference taking place April 23rd through the 25th at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank you.
Coming up, North Carolina hip-hop group Cooley High live here in the studio. Stay tuned.